Well, I don't know if you've seen this flyer, which I hope I can find. Have you got one, Jeff? Thank you. Right. I had one all nicely prepared, but there you are. Summer sermons. Our sermons over the summer are going to focus on our core beliefs as Christians, and we're going to use as our basis for that the Nicene Creed, which we're going to say later together in the service, and which you can find on page 3 of the service booklet. So, I believe, core beliefs of our faith. Creeds. You probably all know, but maybe not everyone does, that the word creed comes from the Latin verb credo, which means to believe or to trust in. So when we say the creed, we are making a statement about what we believe as Christians. Here's the disclaimer. What these sermons will not be about is the history of the creeds. There are some excellent books on that if you're interested. It's a fascinating topic, and it's many doctoral theses probably been written on it. I particularly recommend a book by Francis Young called The Making of the Creeds. But we're actually not going to do with that. However, I will give just a tiny bit of background for those who are not familiar with this whole subject. In the early days of the church, church leaders had to work out exactly what it meant to be a Christian. This was initially so that people who came to baptism knew exactly what they were signing up for, that they were believing in God and Jesus. Later on, all sorts of weird and wonderful ideas, particularly about the nature of Jesus, whether he's fully human or completely God or something in between, grew up. All sorts of heresies, and it became necessary to elaborate that creed a little bit more and to formalize it. And so the creed was developed and formalized and finally agreed in the 4th century in the form that we know it, and we call this the Nicene Creed. There are other creeds, and I think the other one people may be familiar with is the Apostles' Creed, but it's the Nicene Creed which is going to be the basis of our talks in the next few weeks. And this is the creed that is used, I think I'm right in saying, through all mainstream branches of the Christian church. Dino's shaking his head, and I was going to check on the Greek Orthodox church, but it's widely used and accepted. And it's called the Nicene Creed because it was agreed at the Council of Nicaea and later on at the Council of Constantinople, just to confuse us. However, background over. So in its form we know it now, this creed was formulated in the 4th century, a long time ago. But we still use it. It still holds good. And those beliefs summarized in the creed are what we agree to when we become Christians. And as we say the creed each Sunday, we remind ourselves of the essentials of our faith. And I hope it reminds us that we're all singing from the same song sheet on these key points, even though we may disagree on what I could call second-order issues, such as the ordination of women and the acceptance of homosexuals and so many things that the church disagrees on or has difficulty with. But the key elements of belief are those stated in the creed. And what we're going to look at over these 7 Sundays is what these central beliefs mean for us as Christians as we go about our everyday lives. And we're going to start by what it means to believe in God the Father, the Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and of all that is seen and unseen. And you'll find those words on page 3 at the beginning of the creed. When we state boldly that we believe in God, we immediately commit to a view of the world which is quite different from that of people who have no religious faith. And at this point, I'm not distinguishing between different religions. I'm saying all religions who believe in God have a different worldview from people who have no religious belief whatsoever. And it starts us off on a completely different way of looking at things. I mean, somebody whose world is simply a materialistic one, and this is the be-all and end-all, probably have very different attitudes, very different way of dealing with things. So I think we're privileged to believe in God. And in stating our belief in God, we acknowledge that the physical world around us is not all that there is. There is something beyond it, which we do not fully comprehend. And I think it's worth remembering at this point, because we're so used to people denouncing faith and claiming to be atheists, that actually the majority of the world's population still have a religious faith. And the largest section of those are Christians. It's only a minority of people who have no religious belief. So we declare a belief in God. And the creed goes on to state that God not only exists, but that he's our creator. We all know there are lots of different views about how creation actually happened. Literally, as told in the creation stories, inconveniently there are two of them and they don't quite agree, but literally as told in the stories in Genesis, or we may believe, as I do, in the light of more recent scientific theories, in the Big Bang and that view of how the universe was created. But I don't think it matters what view of creation we take. If we're Christians, we do believe that in some way or another, God is the author of creation. To him we owe our existence, our allegiance, and our rationale for being here. And that shapes our lives. The passage which Philip has just read makes very clear that we're an integral part of creation. Now, you probably know that I'm quite a keen environmentalist, and when we talk about the environment and creation and ecos and things, we often think of animals and plants and trees and climates. We don't necessarily think of ourselves, do we? But we are part of creation. And I think it's brought home to us very picturesquely in verse 7 of chapter 2 of Genesis, because we're being described as being formed from the dust of the earth. And you sort of almost imagine God like a potter moulding this earth to form us out of exactly the same materials that form everything else that we know about and many things we don't know about. I think it's interesting because at this point, the story in Genesis really coincides with what scientists believe about creation. We're all actually created from, I think it's a sort of form of stardust, but we're all made out of the same elements. And I think that's rather nice. That should ground us. We are an integral part of creation. But we're also significantly different, aren't we? And we have to look back at Genesis 1, verses 25 and 27. Do look at them if you wish. Because this gives us the clue to how we are different. We're told that God created man, and for that please read people or men and women, in his own image. And I've been asked in talking today to focus on the practical application of what this means. What does it mean to be made in God's image? How does it affect our lives? Now, I'll say very quickly, I don't think it means that we are God lookalikes. I certainly hope that God doesn't look like me. That's slightly blasphemous, but I'm sure he doesn't. When I was a small girl, age 6 or so, at home, I certainly knew what God looked like. He was a bus driver. He was a very specific bus driver. He drove the number 33 bus, which went to the Broadway. That's the Broadway in Wakefield, West Yorkshire. And the bus was interesting. This was heaven. And my image of heaven as a child was as God driving this bus. And I was concerned about when I would get on and who I would find there and where I would sit. Now, I know God doesn't look like a bus driver. And I don't think being made in the image of God means being physically like God. But I do think it means having something of God in us and being able to communicate with God. And I want to think about what the implications of this are, to be made in the image of God. And I'm going to look at it under three headings. What it means for our relationship with God, what it means for our relationship with each other, and what it means for our relationship with our own selves. There is a fourth head, which I'm not going to tackle today, which is what it means for our relationship with the rest of creation. And as an environmentalist, I could bang on about that for many hours, so I won't bore you, but come to People and Planet later. So in terms of our relationship with God, what does this mean? It means that we should be in awe of him and should love and respect him as the one who gave us life. But I think it also suggests that God's want us to be creatures who can have a relationship with him. He makes us in his image so that we can communicate. And the most obvious way of doing this is through prayer, making sure that we set aside times for prayer, and that when we pray, we not only speak to God, we also listen. I wonder how many of us have been on courses about relationships, where we're told that the key to a good relationship is to be able to listen and keep quiet. Oh dear. How many of us have been to such courses, and how many of us have failed miserably? Ask my husband, or perhaps don't. But I think this must be true of our relationship with God. We're very good at asking God things and telling him things, but do we listen? We must. That's part of this wonderful communication we have with God, because we're made in his image. We can communicate. And I don't think it's just about setting aside a specific prayer time each day. Why not keep chatting to God throughout the day? If you see something you like, thank him. If you're worried, turn to him. I find I do this quite a lot now. Simple things. I saw a lovely holly blue butterfly in the garden the other day. Thank God. Sometimes I'm so stressed and absolutely hacked off. Please, God, help. But keep in touch. I read an article in the paper recently about how we're all addicted to technology. And one of the findings from some research was that there were a group of students who clicked onto their phones 60 or 70 times a day to check for messages. Do we click onto God that often? Perhaps we should. Perhaps that would be a rather better habit than clicking onto our phones continuously. So, made in the image of God, keep in touch with him. Then there are relationships with other people. If we take the point about being made in the image of God, we must accept that there is something of God in every person, and this should surely affect the way we treat them. There's a horrible expression people use, so-and-so's a waste of space. It's hideous. I hope I don't use it, but I may have done. But nobody's a waste of space. There's something of God in them. We should not look down or hurt other human beings, as this must surely be an affront to God himself. Nor should we dismiss other people because they seem to be lacking in physical or mental ability. They still have something of God in them, and they should be treated with respect that this demands. Now, there's plenty of teaching in the New Testament to help us about how we should treat others. We read about it in the parables, such as that of the prodigal son and the good Samaritan. And we learn of it from Jesus' own actions, where he sees worth in the most unlikely characters, such as prostitutes, the reviled tax collectors, and the ill-disposed Saul, who, as Paul, became one of the most effective evangelists the world has ever known. There's something in everybody, even in the most unlikely people. And I know, I have to confess, I sometimes find it very hard to love some of my fellow human beings. It's one of the most difficult teachings to follow. But I have been thinking a lot over the past week about what it means to be made in the image of God. And I do hope it will help me to be more tolerant and try harder to see that something of worth in every person. And I think this idea of being made in the image of God actually brings us up against some very hard questions. I mean, often I have an aversion to somebody for some very trivial reason. But I think we can think of people who are some of the most reviled characters in the world. Hitler, Saddam Hussein. It's made me think, were they made in the image of God? Was there something of God in them? Can we ever say anyone is totally evil and beyond redemption? Well, I'm not God, I don't know. But I sort of feel that everyone must be potentially redeemable, or else we really deny the effectiveness of the cross. Something I'm happy to discuss with people afterwards, and it's worried me that I lay that before you as an issue we might have to contend with. And finally, what does God's image, being made in God's image, mean for us in our relationships with ourselves, how we treat ourselves? And I must say, it came as a bit of a shock to me when somebody reminded me that in that summary of the law by Jesus, love God and love your neighbour as yourself, we were supposed to love ourselves. Now, we don't take this the wrong way, I hope. Love of self is not the same as being selfish or arrogant or greedy or vain. I think what it does mean is being willing to recognize that of the Creator in ourselves and trying to get rid of those things which are contrary to his will. It means not abusing our minds or our bodies, and we can think of plenty of ways that people do that, even the best of us. And it means that we must be able to recognize any special gifts or talents, something of worth that God has made in us, however insignificant it might feel to us. There is something of God in us, and we should learn to grow that and develop it and be grateful for it. And I think it's something we could each maybe dwell on when we go home. What has God given me that's special? What can I do to play my part in creation? And so, being made in the image of God affects how we communicate with God, how we deal with each other, and how we conduct ourselves. So I pray that as we go about our daily lives, let us remember that we believe in a mighty God who created us in his image, and take seriously both the responsibility and the hope that this gives us in our relations with God, with each other, and with our very selves. Amen.